Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. April Fool's Day came and went, and so far the feared malware virus called Conficker lurks on infected computers around the world, but hasn't risen up to strike. Meanwhile, GhostNet has. Just days ago, a Canadian team announced it had uncovered a huge computer spying operation, apparently out of China, reaching into and looking and listening out of highly sensitive computers around the world. This hour on Point, we talk to the team that busted GhostNet about how they did it and what we're up against in the world of cyber spying. You can join the conversation. Did the GhostNet story spook you, and can the internet and our computers ever really be secure? We have with us this hour the two lead investigators, co-founders of the Information Warfare Monitor, whose team got wind of, tracked down, and exposed GhostNet. From Toronto, Ron Diebert joins us. He's director of the Citizen Lab at the University of Toronto's Monk Center for International Studies, where GhostNet was uncovered. Ron Diebert, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you. Hi, Tom.
Hi. And with us from Washington, where he's been briefing intelligence experts, Ron's longtime collaborator, Rafal Rohozinski, CEO of SecDev Group and co-leader of the team that tracked down GhostNet. Rafal, thank you for joining us today.
Hello, Tom. Good to be here.
So tell us about this story. Vast electronic spying operation in computers all around the world, stolen documents from hundreds of governments and private offices. And I read, Ron, that in a way this began in the foothills of the Himalayas. Take us back. What happened?
Well, that's right. There were two parts to this investigation. The first part consisted of field investigations that were led by the SecDev fellow at the Citizen Lab, Greg Walton, who has a longstanding relationship with Tibetan communities in exile and is an expert in computer security and Trojan horses and viruses. While in India, working with those communities around best practices and security, they had suspicions that their systems were infected and possibly breaches were leading to issues in relations with China. And so that's where the field investigation began. He set up network monitoring tools on their computers, which led him to infer that documents were being extracted and being sent to IP addresses in China.
So in plain language, what the Tibetan exile group, the Dalai Lama's people, were afraid that they were being spied on. Their computers were being rifled through, and he found evidence right there in Dharamsala in the Himalayan foothills and brought it back to you all. Rafal, how did you begin to dig into this? You had no idea at the beginning what a big network you would uncover.
No, not at all. And in fact, just to go back a little bit, one of the things that we were quite concerned about when we first got these allegations from the Tibetans was whether there were alternative explanations for why information was leaking from their offices. Obviously, the Tibetan exile community is not a state. In other words, they don't have documents that have a classification. They don't necessarily have the best security practices. So obviously, we wanted to make sure before we focused on the technology piece whether there was other reasons and other methods or plausible explanations. We found some, of course, but for us the most damning evidence was the fact that we were able to see documents moving from those computers to specific addresses that were being aided by malware. Now, just having an IP address to which a document goes doesn't necessarily expose a network. And that's really where the strength of the Citizen Lab and the analytical team there, led up by Nart Villeneuve, came into play, because they crunched through an enormous amount of data using a variety of techniques, but one of which was actually Google. And if you want to reduce the story down to a soundbite, it was a 22-character bit that was run through Google that allowed us to identify the first command and control server, which then cracked open the network.
We will come back to Google and exactly how that happened. But, Ron, I wish for us to get a sense of the scale of this as we look at how you tracked it down. Tell us about GhostNet as you eventually came to understand it. What is it, Ron?
Well, GhostNet is the term that we gave to the network of infected computers. There were 1,295 of them located in 103 countries, of which about 27% we had positively identified as high-value targets, meaning they were computers located in the offices of ministries of foreign affairs, diplomatic missions, international organizations, media, non-governmental organizations, and so on. In fact, the concentration of targets was focused mostly on the region of South and Southeast Asia and seemed to have some circumstantial connection to Chinese security and defense policy. And it's one of the pieces of evidence that most people point to as leading them to conclude that this is either a Chinese operation or a operation that's backed by the Chinese state. However, in our report, and as Rafael mentions, our intent in this from the beginning is to engage in very careful evidence-based research. We wanted to evaluate this case, examining all possible explanations. And when you really begin to sift through the data and engage in analysis, you realize that although overwhelmingly, the evidence does seem to point towards China, there are explanations that you could put together that would lead you to believe this is a random set of infected nodes, that it could have been an individual operating this network, or perhaps a criminal organization, or even another state using computers in China that were broken into as a staging post to disguise their real identity. So we, in effect, lifted the lid on a very murky world of geopolitical competition in cyberspace about which most users are unaware.
And what was going on? We'll look at that. China, of course, has stood up and said, these are old stories. This is nonsense. This is a virus of the old Cold War. Come back to haunt us. No more than that. They've been in full denial mode. Some of your colleagues, though, in Britain have been tougher on them, labeling their part of the report the snooping dragon. But what explain to us what actually happened with these computers. I mean, somehow the malware virus would get into them and then allow someone or some people remotely to rifle through their files. And if I understand correctly, Ron, to actually turn on their cameras and microphones and look out through these computers at people who might have been sitting in the room talking maybe about important things halfway around the world?
That's right. What we did in the lab analysis was actually infect a computer in the Citizen Lab, what we call a honeypot computer.
They're in Toronto.
In Toronto, mm-hmm. That's right, and infected ourselves. And through that, we were able to investigate and analyze the toolkit that was used by the attackers so we could understand the capabilities that the attacker had at his or her disposal, which included being able to log keystrokes, to remove documents, and even to turn on web cameras and audio capabilities. So if a laptop that was infected happened to be open and live and connected to the internet during a meeting, it's conceivable that the attacker could have eavesdropped on that meeting. Just backtracking mm-hmm. a bit to the report that you mentioned about colleagues in Cambridge, mm-hmm. I think it's important for those of us who are interested in this area and who are engaged in research that we be very careful not to jump to conclusions that are not supported by the evidence. If there's one thing that you come across often in this area, it's hyperbole mm-hmm. and conspiracy theory. Mm-hmm. And it's very easy for someone to look at circumstantial evidence and make grave accusations. But I really think those of us who are experts in this area have a responsibility to draw conclusions from the evidence at hand. And certainly in that report, there is not evidence to draw such conclusions. I think it's irresponsible.
Though you can see from the context why people might, I mean, apart from their research, which I haven't looked at directly, but you had just the day before your report came out, the new U.S. Director of National Intelligence, Dennis Blair, was saying that Chinese hackers constitute the single biggest foreign threat to American computerized data. He said, China, I think, is winning the sweepstakes for the origin of the most attacks on U.S. organizations. So you've got people in high places sort of pointing yeah. in that direction, though you've said, Ron, that, you know, China is definitely not the only country that engages in this kind of activity.
That's the whole point here, is that cyberspace is becoming increasingly militarized. There's an arms race in cyberspace. And so for those of us who want to document and, in fact, even rein in this intense competition beneath the surface of the Internet, we need to develop methods for what you might call arms control verification. And just like in other realms of arms control, those methods need to be very sound. So it's up to us as researchers to develop technologies, to develop a suite of investigative capabilities that allow us to determine with as much precision as possible attribution. And attribution itself is a very difficult matter in these cases because of the nature of the Internet in part, but also because the threshold for engaging in these type of attacks is so low today that almost anyone can participate in them. For example, the main tool that was used, GhostRat, is readily available to download freely off the Internet. It has a very nice graphical user interface. You don't need to be a computer expert to use it. Just as we were able to log into the control servers that were used in this attack, people located anywhere in the world could have broken into computers in China and used them to stage an attack. Now, the circumstantial evidence is very powerful, but like I said, others can make conclusions that are hyperbole, but we as researchers need to be extremely cautious.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the big international computer spying network just uncovered, apparently out of China, but who knows? It's been called GhostNet. We're talking with two lead members of the team that tracked it down. Rafael Rohozinski joins us from Washington. He's CEO of the SecDev Group. Ron Diebert is with us from Toronto, co-lead investigator, a co-founder with Rafael of Information Warfare Monitor. He's at the Monk Center for International Studies in Toronto. Rafael, take us into this tracking down. I mean, you knew, you figured out that the Tibetan exiles were being watched by someone, and there was evidence, as I understand it, that people had read their files, gotten inside their planning, and sort of getting a jump on their activities. But when you began this, you had no idea that it was more than 1,000 key computers around the world that were infected and being watched. Explain exactly for non-computer listeners how Google came into play here, Rafael.
Well, when we were actually looking through what you might call the wiretap evidence that we gathered in Tibet or in India among the Tibetan community, mm-hmm. We were looking for patterns that we could recognize, something that would identify the malware, how it was operating. And one of our researchers in Toronto, Nard Villeneuve, actually identified that. The secret was trying to figure out where that file call or that little bit was going to. Mm. So our researcher basically ran it through Google in a very intensive way and was able to identify from that a single control server. Once we had that single control server, we were then able to probe it, and much to our surprise, the interface to it was just like any other web page, which means we were able to surf to it, and by simply observing it over a period of time, we could watch computers checking in. Now, at first, we didn't really think we found anything special. We thought, okay, these kinds of spy nets exist all the time. In mm-hmm. fact, just over two weeks ago, a group in the States found a spy net of over 300,000 computers, mostly home machines in the U.S. and North America, where clearly the intent was to gather personal information, personal data for criminal purposes. But what surprised us about our network is this persistence of high-value targets. Ministries of Foreign Affairs, of Iran, for example, of Bhutan, the ASEAN Secretariat, the Indian, actually the main governmental mail server within the Indian government, which then basically compromised most of their diplomatic missions abroad. I mean, this was pretty serious. And for us, that particular angle of it, the fact that this seemed to be such a specialized network, which didn't have a clear criminal intent, really had us focus in on it. Once we infected ourselves, of course, we were able to discover a lot more.
Now, the control servers, there's different kinds of servers involved here, but what, you track them down to Hainan Island in the South China Sea, Chinese territory, just off of Vietnam, also to Guangdong, and in the U.S., Rafael, as I understand, something in California.
Yeah, correct. We managed to track down in the end four of what we call command and control servers. The difference between the two of them are really subtle. One simply controls the Trojan itself. The other one passes commands to the Trojan.
What's the Trojan?
Well, there are several, and that's what's interesting about this network. The one that we were able to
I mean, what
identify,
is a Trojan, if you could just define
well,
that
it's,
for us?
Well, it's like a Trojan horse. It's mm-hmm. something which is dropped onto your computer, which seems to you not to indicate anything, but within it, it hides code that allows the mm-hmm. malicious attacker to take control of it. Mm-hmm. And in this case, the attacker or attackers used several. Our speculation is that after initially reconnoitering the system, in other words, finding out where the computer was located, they would decide which specific Trojan to use. So if it was a computer that was located in a secure environment, they may drop in a Trojan which is completely unknown. In less secure environments, they dropped in one which, as Ron said, was called Ghost Rat, which when we further tested it, it really does give this unlimited access to a person's computer. But the worrying thing here is that when we ran the vector, the way that this infection was spread, through something called Total Virus, which is a system that allows you to check what all known virus or all known virus software detection programs, only 11 out of 34 were able to pick up that one very simple vector that we found.
Now, once they were in the computer, Ron, they could look at all of its files, they could extract information from that computer, and as you say, they could even sort of watch and listen through that computer, I guess.
That's right. Exactly right.
And went on undetected in all of these computers and all these government ministries until you guys tracked them down? Do you know?
It seems to be that way. We've had an interesting response, to say the least. We released the report in coordination with a New York Times exclusive, and interestingly, that New York Times report downplayed the full scope of the infections around the world, especially affecting these high-value targets. It's not that they didn't mention it. It just wasn't the main focus of the report. Mm-hmm. And so there was initial interest in the story, and then gradually, I think, personnel at government ministries began to slowly take notice and realize the full scope of what we've uncovered. And as Rafal said, it was really quite unsettling for us to look at the list of high-impact targets that we had positively identified. And once we put it in a list and you know, almost every day we would look at it and shake our heads in astonishment. You know, ministries of foreign affairs, embassies, international organizations, it regardless of who ultimately is behind this, the fact that such a network of strategic intelligence could be gathered together in one system is really quite eye-opening.
Not the United States government as a target, at least from what I've read. Is that true, Ron?
That's right. And as I said before, it seemed to have a South Asian, Southeast Asian focus, although there were a few infecting computers that would fall outside of that range. And that, again, is why we were led to conclude that the most probable explanation is this is either a Chinese-backed operation or one that is involving the Chinese state directly.
We've got questions for you from our listeners from Omaha, Nebraska. Bruce is on the line. Hi, Bruce. You're on the air.
Hi, I have just one quick question, and I'll ask, and then I'll take your answer offline.
Mm-hmm.
Would not an up-to-date firewall, an anti-spyware program, and patches on all of these machines, or any of these machines have stopped these attacks? And I guess that's my question.
Yep. Thank you, Bruce. Rafael, let me put that to you.
Well, let me give a very simple answer. Many of these institutions that we found that were affected were institutions that invest very, very heavily into information security.
Mm-hmm.
And in one or two of them that I can't name, when we told them the specific name of the computer that had been infected, they realized that this is a very key piece of their infrastructure, and they had not detected the infection on it, in some cases, as long as 300 days. So up-to-date firewalls and up-to-date virus protection doesn't seem to be something which will defeat a persistent and focused attacker.
And you're not talking about sort of shrink-wrapped over-the-counter firewall protection like an ordinary consumer might have. These are governments. This is the Indian government.
Correct, and also corporations, which invest a lot into information security because they have information that they wish to keep confidential.
I want to get some perspective on this whole story. Rafael, Ron, if you'd stand by for a moment, we're joined now also from Washington by Siobhan Gorman, intelligence correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. Siobhan, thanks a lot for being here.
Great to be with you.
What do you make of the significance of this uncovered ghost net, Siobhan?
Well, I think that it's perhaps the latest example of evidence of a pretty pervasive cyber espionage effort that goes on. You know, the Chinese pursue it, the Russians pursue it. You know, I mean, certainly to some degree, the United States and the UK and other countries also pursue cyber spying operations. This is sort of a whole new frontier because a lot of the most important information that governments and organizations have now is linked up to the internet, whether it is, you know, really critical information for a government, intelligence information, or in many cases, even critical infrastructure such as subways or nuclear power plants are also connected up to the internet. So this is just a really good example of how pervasive these types of spying operations are. I mean, we've seen a series of them. Some of the most worrisome ones have been attacks on Defense Department computers. There was an operation that was dubbed by U.S. officials Titan Rain, which I think is now called Byzantine Hades as intelligence and defense officials continue to watch it. But that was a quite persistent or is a quite persistent attack by what are believed to be Chinese cyber spies on Defense Department organizations and defense contractors.
So given all that, the pervasiveness you speak of, Siobhan, is it fair to have any kind of presumption of security these days, or do people, should everybody basically assume that their information at any given point may well be compromised, open to, you know, spies?
My understanding is that these days it's probably more likely than not that at some point your computer will at least be harnessed to operate one of these spying operations, if not, you know, be penetrated itself, yeah.
Ron, so yeah. What's the right presumption here, that you're always being watched? I mean, the Chinese military, as the by the U.S. description, is bent on using asymmetric, non-traditional ways to offset the U.S., for example, command and control military advantage. So if you could go in and disrupt it via computer, the U.S. could have all the armaments in the world, and if they can't use them when they need them, because, you know, that's an advantage. That's one way this is used. Is the presumption of security then just wrong?
Well, I think my colleague in your studio, Rafael, put this very well a few days ago when he said the Harry Potter days of the internet are over, and I think that captures very well thoughts that I've had about this, which is, for the average internet user, when they think about cyberspace, they don't think much beyond the computer screen in front of them. They send an email and it goes out into the ether, or they request a website and it magically appears. But if you took the time and followed the data down the fiber optic line to a router, to an internet service provider, to an internet exchange point, to an international gateway, undersea cable, every step along the way there is a possible choke point where authorities and private actors could either block access to information or monitor communications. And that's happening quite extensively. Siobhan, I know, has reported on NSA eavesdropping operations going on at internet exchange points and elsewhere. So I think what this and other reports represent is a wake-up call that cyberspace is now a domain of intense geopolitical contestation. And it's going to have consequences, I think, for the nature of communications globally. And I think it should force us to begin to think about ways to control this competition. It's analogous to me to the situation regarding nuclear weapons prior to nuclear arms control and mutual assured destruction emerging. There's mutual interdependencies here. Governments are developing very advanced operational capabilities and exercising them strategically, and we're just beginning to understand the full depth of all of this.
Maybe so, Siobhan. Maybe the equivalent of nuclear weapons agreements. But, you know, those you could kind of monitor, even when they were buried deep in the earth. Satellite would float over. You could see what people were doing here. This is so much in the dark. Even if you had agreements, how would you begin to know that people were abiding by them, Siobhan?
That's actually something that I know U.S. officials, and I would have to assume government officials around the world, are really struggling with now, is how you set up some form of deterrence in cyberspace because of the attribution problem that we were talking about earlier, where it's very hard to know who is actually conducting the attack. How do you deter that kind of thing? I mean, one sort of inherent deterrent that the United States has, for example, with China, is that China has so much of its money invested in the United States. And so doing something that would really wreak havoc on the U.S. economy would actually create a great problem for China. But, you know, that could change over time, or, you know, there could be actors other than people who are fully aware of that on the Chinese side who would still, you know, use some sort of cyber technique to wreak havoc on U.S. financial markets, U.S. infrastructure systems, things like that. And I'm speaking of the U.S., but this would be true in just about any country. And so I know that this it's an issue that is emerging in foreign policy circles, but traditionally, at least in the United States, foreign policy circles and sort of the tech geek circles don't converge all of that much. And you're starting to see a little bit more of it, particularly, I think, at the Pentagon, where people consider what the implications of cyber warfare are. If the United States discovers that it has truly been attacked via some sort of cyber mechanism, what do you do? How do you retaliate? Who do you retaliate against? And I know that those are the kinds of questions being raised, but my understanding is that so far there aren't so many answers.
And what if it's not? A government will look at that. Let me get a call from Newburyport, Massachusetts. Tom, you're on the air.
Hello. I just have a comment about the whole premise of this discussion. I have worked in the security consulting field for a couple of years, and I'd just like to mention that even bank vaults are rated in minutes to penetrate. There is no presumption of security. It's all just a matter of degree. Everything is penetrable.
Mm-hmm. So, the idea of a solid wall, well and truly gone, but then it's all about degrees, I guess, Ron. At this point, everything's penetrable, but...
And that begs the question of, are there ways to minimize the risks? And I think there are. For example, the system that we uncovered was focused almost entirely on Windows operating systems. And so there has been a very vibrant policy debate in especially developing country contexts for government ministries and departments to invest in open source operating systems that would be much less affected by the type of Trojan horses and viruses that we've described. I think there are things that could be done at a policy level. There could be incentives for companies that create software to focus more on security than they do presently, which is often a distant priority for many of them. And lastly, I think there's just an awareness-raising issue here. Many people, as I said before, are unaware of what goes on beneath the surface of the Internet, and our job at the Information Warfare Monitor is in part to raise awareness about what's going on, but in part to develop the very techniques that you asked about in your previous question as to how we would go about verifying any type of verification system when it comes to arms control in this area should any agreements ever arise.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the big international computer spying network just uncovered, apparently out of China, but who knows, being called GhostNet. We're talking with two lead members of the team that tracked it down. Ron Diebert is with us from Toronto at the Monk Center for International Studies. He co-led the team that exposed GhostNet. And from Washington, Rafael Rohozinski is with us, co-leader as well, CEO of the SecDev Group. They're both involved with the Information Warfare Monitor. And with us from Washington, Siobhan Gorman is here, intelligence correspondent for the Wall Street Journal. And what a picture they have unpacked. Let's take some calls. Javed is calling from Boston. Javed, you're on the air.
Tom, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
Two questions for the InfoWire team. When the reports came out, I tried to get to their website, and I couldn't for one whole day. Was it under an attack, or was it just too many people trying to get to the report?
Yeah, okay.
And The second question is, I'm from a country called Bangladesh, I'm in information security myself.
Mm-hmm.
So I see four machines in the Bangladesh Foreign Ministry had Ghostrat installed on them. And I've spoken to some people back there, and they are completely oblivious as to the possible impact. And I need to get them more information on that. And I was wondering how I could get more specific information on which machines, etc.
Rafael, what do you say to Javed? First of all, your own computers, were they just overwhelmed when you released the report, or were you under attack? And he's worried about his own home country, Bangladesh, and how they can get up to speed on what's going on. What do you say, Rafael?
Well, first of all, to the first question, we were overwhelmingly swamped with requests, and given that our site was not running off the most modern technology, it simply died under the load.
Yeah.
With respect to notification, I mean, this is something that we took a long, hard look at because of the nature of the targets. We felt that we really did need to go through a due diligence process in ensuring that we went through proper channels so that competent authorities would be notified first, since obviously a lot of these machines were compromised within government ministries. So after some consultation, we decided to go through a Canadian government entity, which was the Canadian Cyber Incident Reporting Center, which maintains bilateral relationships with computer emergency response teams in most of the affected countries. So the data has been passed to them on the victim lists, and they then will be contacting their equivalent within the countries affected to make sure that the computers are at least, or they're given the opportunity to clean the computers.
So there should be a notice coming along. It certainly has been no secret all over the press, at least in this country, I would think, around the world. Let's go to Nashville and Aaron. Aaron, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks.
Mm-hmm.
Two quick questions. Is there any kind of forensic info or other indications in the delivered executables or other files that would point towards the authors? And the other thing is that I'm not hearing a lot of talk about something that's actually more disturbing than just like the national-to-national spying that's going on. You know, especially since you're talking about the Tibetan dissidents, we're also talking about the ability of a country to keep track of and find people it thinks are less than desirable.
So going after dissidents, even if they're not, in Tibetan's case, not a sitting government.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Ron, how about it? I wish you could take us deeper into the forensics, first of all. I mean, please.
Well, let me answer the second first, actually, because the Information Warfare Monitor released a report in the fall that speaks directly to that question. We had in our first major release, and it was the same team, in fact, had uncovered a massive surveillance system on the Chinese version of the popular chatting and voice over internet phone program Skype. And in that case, the evidence led us to believe that this was a targeted operation by the Chinese intelligence services against dissident groups, and in particular an outreach campaign that was being organized by pro-democracy groups through Skype, using Skype as a vehicle. They had assumed that it was the most secure method of engaging in outreach.
Because it was internet telephony.
And it was advertised as providing secure end-to-end encryption. In fact, many human rights organizations and dissidence groups have long suggested and recommended that activists use Skype for that reason. And what we had found is that contrary to the pronouncements and literature around Skype, that the Chinese version had modified the code and had set up a system whereby chats containing keywords were being uploaded to servers in China and then monitored. And it was actually a quite similar process of investigation. The same lead investigator, Nart Villeneuve, happened to identify servers that were containing the logs of these correspondences, and the servers were set up in an insecure manner. So in both the Skype and the GhostNet case, it was ironically, I suppose, poor security procedures on the part of the attackers that allowed us to peek inside this whole underbelly of the internet, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And for me, that raises the question, well, if we were able to stumble upon these two, what is going on out there that we aren't able to stumble upon in this way? There's obviously much more happening.
Ron, since you raised that first, let me put that piece to Siobhan. That sounds, Siobhan Gorman, I don't know, to a layman, not unlike what the United States government began doing after the attacks of 9/11, tapping into phone conversations. I don't know about Skype in this country, but certainly a lot of listening in for keywords in the telephony realm.
Well, what the U.S. government was doing was a little bit different because it was mainly searching through what's called metadata, which would be data about communications that would help it map out threats and perhaps build a case for why it should be listening in on communications and conversations. So it's sort of a little bit more indirect, maybe one step removed from the kind of thing that they're talking about going on with Skype in China. But it's certainly the same concept, but just looking more at patterns and data about the data, and then if they can build a case to dig a little bit deeper and actually track communications, the content of communications.
We've got more questions on the authorship of GhostNet. Aaron, we won't forget that. But let me go to Paul in Sunderland, Massachusetts. Paul, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. You've talked much about whether or not China has been the originator of this. I was wondering if there's a possibility that the U.S. might be, and they're using Chinese sites as cover.
Let's dig in there further. Rafael, how about it? First, the evidence that led to China, and then what can you figure out trying to peer into or through that evidence, Rafael?
Well, there's a number of threads of evidence. First of all, all the targets that were hit certainly were targets that had a significance to Chinese defense, economic, or foreign policy. Secondly, three of the four control servers were located in China. Fourthly, the interface that allowed the attackers to use the system was written in Chinese, so presumably someone who's a Chinese speaker or a Chinese reader would be able to use it. The last piece of evidence really was gathered when we infected ourselves with the Trojan and were watching to see who would connect in. The connection was made from Hainan Island. Now, there is a chance, or there would be a possibility, that someone, as Ron said, could proxy through Hainan Island, meaning sort of use it as a jumping-off point. But in order for them to do that, they essentially would have to wait until someone in Hainan Island connected to the Internet first, and that our computer was connected at the same time in order to make the connection. That wasn't the case in what we discovered. In other words, the moment that we got lit up, the moment that our system was compromised and taken over by the attacker, that attacker clearly was working off an address that was working and waiting full time in Hainan.
Now,
Hainan Island happens to be the location of the main signals intelligence facility of the People's Liberation Army.
Though, with all that, there's been speculation that this might not be the Chinese government, even if it originates in China, that could be so-called patriotic hackers. Ron, what does that mean, patriotic hackers?
Patriotic hackers is a term that's been used widely to describe the swarming activities that occur mostly out of China, but it applies to other countries just as well. When there is a high-profile public event or some kind of cyber attack, denial-of-service attack, let's say, against prominent websites or comment postings on prominent YouTube videos, citizens get involved and pile on. And there is it's clear that this happens often in the case of China. Chinese citizens, both in China and abroad, tend to be quite nationalistic, and like citizens of every country are concerned when charges are raised against their own country and respond in a variety of ways, some of which can include hacking. And I think what it points to, and especially this gets back to the main tool that was used here, GhostRat, that the Internet has democratized many things, including the ability to engage in signals intelligence. We've entered the age of DIY signals intelligence.
Do it yourself.
Exactly. And so that's why we have to be very cautious about attribution. There are ways to disguise your identity that Rafael talked about. The tools are readily available. It's not like you have to be a technocrat in some specialized guild in order to take on these type of operations. It's something that can be done by individuals.
And you were very careful at the top of the hour not to pin this in a confirmed way on China or the Chinese government, but as Rafael described, the You know, it sounds like the odds of it being someone other than in China seem pretty small, as he described it there, Ron.
Well, like I said, I think it's important for those of us who are the researchers in this area. If we're going to put ourselves at the leading edge and try to develop methodologies and a suite of investigative tools that probe the issue of attribution, unless we are 100% certain, we need to exhaust alternative explanations. And that's why I found this other report that you referred to really objectionable in my mind, because people of that stature shouldn't be jumping to conclusions. I think the first line in that report was, we've uncovered an operation involving agents of the Chinese state. Their report focused on a very small field investigation in Tibet, among Tibetan organizations, and certainly their evidence doesn't substantiate the claims that they made in that case, and that's why I said we need to be careful.
Mm. Let's get a call from Charleston, South Carolina, and John. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, what's on your mind?
When I heard your series earlier on China, you interviewed a gentleman who discussed the fact that Microsoft had released their source code for their operating systems to the Chinese government.
Right. We talked with the former head of Microsoft in China. Yeah.
Yeah, correct. And I'm curious if your panel believes, especially since this attack was targeted mostly at Microsoft operating systems, if that gave the Chinese government an advantage having the source code in order to exploit some vulnerabilities that may not be widely known.
Interesting. Rafael?
Just one thing I'd like to clarify.
Yes.
A lot of the end user systems may have been Microsoft operating system, but we certainly don't know that all of them were. So pointing the finger at Microsoft as being, you know, the source of insecurity in this case, I think is a little bit misleading.
Exactly.
I think that in some of the larger institutions that were hit, it's reasonably clear that they were not Microsoft-based systems. So this is a wider problem than just simply one insecure operating system.
So bigger than that, maybe. Oscar in Worcester, Massachusetts. Oscar, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you. I heard a caller say something earlier about maybe this is being controlled or applied by the United States government, but even if it isn't it safe to assume that maybe the applications in use by the United States government are far, far advanced than what has just been discovered? Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah. Siobhan Gorman, what about it? The U.S. government with its own equivalent of GhostNet out there snooping and probing and listening in, is that assumed or not?
It should be, certainly, overseas. I mean, that is what we pay the people at the National Security Agency to do. You know, they've been working for years, actually, to try to figure out how to truly, adapt to an internet age where they can suck up all of the information, but yet figure out that is essentially on the internet, but yet figure out what bits and pieces they truly care about. And that has actually been a challenge that the National Security Agency has really been facing for the better part of a decade now, is just struggling with all of the information now that is out there available on the internet, everything from video downloads to chat rooms to emails and just sort of basic communications. How is it that U.S. security officials can sift through all of that and figure out what are the indications of threats to our country and how to piece that together and understand it and do something about it? That's actually been the real challenge that they've been facing, is that they want very much to figure out how to do that. And they've chipped away at it, but they're not there yet.
Ron Diebert, you spoke earlier about maybe the need for something equivalent to the agreements, sort of non-aggression pacts we had with nuclear weapons earlier, still have. Are we getting to the point, if everybody's out there doing some version of this, that there's the same kind of mutually assured destruction, that there's a kind of balance of terror in the cyber spying and intervention realm that puts everybody on the same page? Or do you have the sense that some countries or entities are way ahead of others and see it in their interest to, you know, keep it dark and forge ahead on the spying?
Hmm. Well, it's an interesting question. Mutually assured crashes, you might call them. There is obviously large degree of interdependence, and networks are connected globally. I think Siobhan said earlier that the Chinese have great stakes in infrastructures within the United States, banking systems and so on. That's absolutely correct. But one of the vexing issues here is precisely the fact that individuals, non-state actors, can get involved so easily, and that poses a particular challenge when it comes to parties to any type of agreement. How do you ensure that individuals are going to comply? You simply can't. And so there's a paradox at the center of this, and that's in order to save the internet, do we have to change the internet entirely? And for someone who, as myself, who spent his career really working to protect and promote the internet as a forum for free expression, this is a really troubling paradox.
Rafael, we've just got half a minute here. What about GhostNet itself? Is it still out there, humming away, sucking down information, maybe listening in on you right now?
Well, as of yesterday, the GhostNet that we found was still operational. And as I said, it's only the tip of the iceberg. To just give a sense of on what Ron said, I think part of the problem here is that we're still really focused on cybersecurity when we really should be focused on the nature of cyber power, where technology is only a component of how cyberspace has really changed the dimension of the exercise of power, either at an individual or a state level. We haven't figured out how to maneuver in cyberspace, and until we do that, we can't really talk about security in the way that we understand it now.
Well, it's a fascinating story about GhostNet, Ron Diebert, and Rafael Rohozinski, co-leaders of the crew who uncovered it, brought us the whole story. Thank you very much, Ron and Rafael, for your work, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks very much, Tom.
It's great to have you. Siobhan Gorman at the Wall Street Journal, intelligence correspondent there. Siobhan, always great to have you as well. Thank you very much for being here today.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org, and follow us on Twitter at On Point Radio. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.